Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 932. The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 1. This is being recorded on November 16th of the year 2016. In the wake of Donald Trump's elevation to the presidency, having lost the popular vote and having been placed in the White House as a result of a number of things, including the outmoded Electoral College system and a great many factors gaming the system, I'm going to be doing something for some time that I have not done before. I'm going to simply read into the record the vast bulk of an excellent biography of Donald Trump called The Making of Donald Trump, authored by David K. Johnston. That's K is C-A-Y. Johnston, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N. This book was published in hardcover by Melville House and is copyrighted 2016. In my 38th year on the air, I have, of course, read a great many political books. I have read none better than this. It is not a book about fascism per se, and that is the primary focal point of these broadcasts over the 37-plus years that I've been doing them. However, indirectly, this book is. It is a very good book, and yet a very short book, hence the ability or the capacity to read the vast bulk of it directly into the record. Let me do a couple of things right off the bat. First of all, I have no financial stake in the book, nor does any of the stations that cover that air this program have any financial stake in the book. We have no money in this particular fight. I also, in the descriptions for the show, will only be putting small amounts of the text into the records so that people can perhaps use them on social media or transmit them on social media, so that most of the book I will not even attempt to put into the description for the program. It is not a long book at all, roughly the main body of text, roughly 210 pages. However, I think that this book serves as a mirror. And in this book, in the information that it discloses about Donald Trump, this country and its citizens and its institutions can view themselves. And what it says about Donald Trump, and by extension, what it says about our country, what it says about our citizens, what it says about our institutions, and how they could allow a creature like this to assume the highest political office in the land. Well, I think the book itself will make an eloquent and very important and altogether tragic statement. I will be interviewing, God willing, and the quick don't rise, the author in the wake of my readings of the book directly into the record. Again, I have no financial stake in this. In the wake of Trump's, quote, election, unquote, the responses that I have heard, the reactions have been really very predictable, almost like a cartoon. by Jules Pfeiffer, where someone is looking into a mirror and saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, and they go right through the mirror to the other side of the mirror. So much of the responses that I have heard are simply confirmation of the prejudices and the editorial points that the commentators had previously endorsed. We've heard the so-called progressive sector saying that, well, Bernie would have won and all sorts of things along those lines, and various people saying various things about the campaign. Almost no one commenting, with the exception of Hillary Clinton, about the remarkable role that Mitt Romney's supporter, James Comey, and his FBI played in this. But then that was quite predictable as well. I'm going to begin this program, or the substantive part of it, and I think maybe the other programs as well, by reading a poem. And my reaction to the Trump, quote, election, unquote, really is embodied in and encompassed by, or encompassed in and embodied in this poem. This poem is by Robinson Jeffers, J as in Johnson, E, F as in Frank, F as in Frank, E-R-S. It's titled, Be Angry at the Sun, and it reads, that public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not capitalists, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. Let boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women perhaps for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. Again, Be Angry at the Sun by Robinson Jeffers. I think there could be no better yardstick of how far this country has sunk than the following article taken in conjunction with this remarkable book, The Making of Donald Trump, by David K. Johnston. From ABC News, Good Morning America, from November 2nd of 2016, by Megan, M-E-G-H-A-N, Keneally, K-E-N-E-A-L-L-Y. Why an honesty poll shows an advantage to Trump, disadvantage to Clinton. Donald Trump is currently tracking as the more honest of the two presidential candidates in a poll, although fact-checking of his statements during the campaign has shown he's lied several times. The latest ABC News Washington Post tracking poll reports that 46% of likely voters believe he is the more honest and trustworthy candidate, while 38% believed it was Hillary Clinton. This marks the biggest gap between the two candidates in five ABC News Washington Post polls that asked the question beginning in May. I would note that this article or post itself is dishonest. Fact-checking of Trump's campaign did not show he lied several times Boy, is that an understatement. The late Hunter S. Thompson would have said of Donald Trump, he's so crooked he has to screw his pants on in the morning. He lied more than several times. That would imply, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 times. It was a whole lot more than that. And I think that that article showing that the American people felt that Donald Trump was the more trustworthy of the two candidates, the more honest of the two candidates, really sums things up.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I'm going to begin now by reading, again, most, not all, but most of the text of a short, concise, incisive, very important, beautifully researched and written book, The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, Into the Record. I'm not going to read much about Trump's family history. However, I think by way of a point of entry, some information about Fred Trump, who preceded Donald Trump, his son, in the construction business. Friedrich Trump, by the way, or Fred in English, was Donald's grandfather. We're going to hear what happened with the son William of Frederick Trump III, Donald's brother. But by way of assessing honest Donald, unquote, the following, I think, will be a very interesting point of entry. Taxpayers were not the only source of capital for Fred Trump's construction projects. A few years after the war ended, he took on a partner known as Willie, W-I-L-L-I-E, Tomasello, T-O-M-A-S-E-L-L-O. When cash was short, Tomasello was able to provide Trump with operating capital on short notice. Tomasello also saw to it that there was no trouble from the unions, from the bricklayers and carpenters, to the Teamsters. The New York State Organized Crime Task Force identified Tomasello as an associate of the Genovese and Gambino crime families in New York. In other words, just as Friedrich Trump had engaged in illicit businesses to build his fortune in the late 19th century, his son Fred Trump turned to an organized crime associate as his longtime partner to build his own. Decades later, his son Donald Trump would also do business with the heads of the same families, though at a remove, developing numerous business connections with an assortment of criminals, from con artists and a major drug trafficker to the heads of the two largest mafia families in New York City, as we shall see. One of the really fascinating things about the Trump elevation, shall we say, concerns the knowledge and beyond that, the speech and rhetoric of Donald Trump. For an example, in the introduction to the book, David K. Johnston writes, during the presidential debate hosted by CNN in December of 2015, the conservative radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, asked Trump, what's your priority among our nuclear triad, unquote. Well, first of all, I think we need somebody absolutely that we can trust who is totally responsible, who really knows what he or she is doing, Trump responded. That is so powerful and so important. And one of the things that I'm frankly most proud of is that in 2003, 2004, I was totally against going into Iraq because you're going to destabilize the Middle East. I called it very strongly, and it was very important. But we have to be extremely vigilant and extremely careful when it comes to nuclear. Nuclear changes the whole ballgame. Frankly, I would have said, get out of Syria. Get out if we didn't have the power of weaponry today. The power is so massive that we can't just leave areas that 50 years ago or 75 years ago we wouldn't care about. It was hand-to-hand combat, unquote. By the way, that is a lie right there. Trump was not against the war in Iraq until after it began. He was for it prior to the actual invasion. So that right there is a lie. Back to the interview, Hewitt then followed up asking, of the three legs of the triad, though, do you have a priority? Trump responded, I think for me, nuclear is just the power. The devastation is very important to me. Hewitt then turned to Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, whom Trump derided as an empty suit. Do you have a response? First, let's explain to people at home what the triad is, Rubio said. The triad is our ability in the United States to conduct nuclear attacks using airplanes, using missiles launched from silos or from the ground, or from our nuclear subs, unquote. This was not the first time Trump had been asked about how he would allocate money among the three different methods by which the U.S. military can deliver nuclear bombs. 4 months earlier, Hewitt had asked Trump the same question on his radio show. Trump gave an answer indicating he had no idea what Hewitt was talking about. He had clearly made no effort in the intervening months to learn. Quote, I think one of the most important things that we have to worry about is nuclear, generally speaking, Trump said on Hewitt's radio show. The power of nuclear, the power of the weapons that we have today, and that is, by the way, the deal with Iran, the concept of it is so important that you have to make a good deal, and what they should have done is they should have doubled up and tripled up the sanctions, unquote. And that is not, that is sadly representative, I think, of not only Trump's understanding of the issues, but of the nature of the rhetoric through which he addresses those issues. Another example, Trump initially, as an undergraduate student, went to Fordham University. He ultimately transferred to the University of Pennsylvania. That is an Ivy League school. And the Wharton School, W-H-A-R-T-O-N, the graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania, is among the very best graduate business programs in the U.S. Trump was there not as a graduate student, but as an undergraduate. And of his education, Trump says, Kay writes about Trump, or Johnson rather writes about Trump. Nonetheless, Trump touts his 1968 bachelor's degree in economics and says he learned super genius stuff at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. I was a really good student at the best school, Trump told Barbara Walters on her show The View. I'm like a smart guy, unquote. Wharton, like all business schools, teaches fundamental tools for evaluating whether investments are likely to be profitable. One such concept is net present value, or NPV. That is the value of cash expected from an investment minus the value spent to support that investment and then reduced to a lump sum payable today. Business and finance graduates of Ivy League schools know this concept the way primary school students know that 2 plus 2 equals 4. In the lawsuit Trump filed against journalist Timothy L. O'Brien for writing that Trump's net worth may be far less than $1 billion, A lawyer asked Trump questions about his knowledge of finance and how he determined his net worth. Are you familiar with the concept of net present value? Lawyer Andrew Ceresny asked. That man's name, Ceresny. One more time. Are you familiar with the concept of net present value? The concept of net present value to me, Trump replied, would be the value of the land currently after debt. Well, to me, the word net is an interesting word. It's really the word value is the important word. If you have an asset that you can do other things with, but you don't choose to do them, I haven't chosen to do that, unquote. After hearing that gibberish, the lawyer asked Trump to explain another basic business concept taught to finance students, generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP. Did he understand GAAP? No, Trump said, I'm not an accountant. Unquote. And again, I'm not going to read this entire book into the record. I'm not going to read the parts about Trump's background, for example.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
We're going to move directly to Chapter 3. This chapter is called Personal Values. In 2005, Donald Trump flew to Colorado to give a motivational talk. Accompanying him were his wife, Melania, and a violent convicted felon and swindler named Felix Sater, S-A-T-E-R, who was helping Trump make two major development deals in Denver. Trump and Sater gave interviews to the Rocky Mountain News, interviews that would prove to be significant a few years later. The three took a limousine an hour north to Loveland, solid Republican territory where more than 1,000 people had paid to hear Trump's advice on how to succeed in life and business. Motivational speakers like Zig Ziglar and Tony Robbins work up audiences with carefully crafted talks. They make lofty appeals to people about vanquishing inner demons so a better self can flourish and dreams of success can morph into reality. Trump's talk was nothing like that. For more than an hour, Trump let fly one four-letter expletive after another. He had no prepared text, much less a rehearsed presentation. He ripped into the location and functionality of the Denver International Airport. The rambling remarks were rich with denunciations of former wives and former business associates. In vilifying a former employee saying she had been disloyal, Trump gratuitously described her as ugly as a dog, unquote. I have to tell you about losers, Trump told the audience. I love losers because they make me feel so good about myself, unquote. Had Loveland's Bixpo 2005 conference invited the loser to speak, he assured the crowd, the fee would have been $3 rather than the freaking fortune, unquote, paid to Trump. However large the speaking fee had been, it did not motivate Trump to show enough respect for the paying audience to prepare even a simple outline. Many in the crowd said afterward that none of his talk was useful and certainly not uplifting. However, within Trump's inchoate vitriol, some in the audience did identify two recommendations on how to succeed in life and business. First, Trump advised, trust no one, especially good employees. Be paranoid, he said, because they're going to try to fleece you. It was strange advice, as some in the audience told local reporters afterward, because trust is central to market capitalism. Business people known for being trustworthy attract better workers, who in turn make their businesses run better. Trustworthy entrepreneurs make the economy more efficient by reducing friction in business deals. Business owners who are prudent about making promises and are known for honoring their word often go through life without a single lawsuit. Trump has been a party in more than 3,500 lawsuits, some of them accusing him of civil fraud, an issue we will examine in another chapter. Second, Trump recommended revenge as business policy. Get even, he said. If somebody screws you, you screw them back 10 years over. At least you can feel good about it. Boy, do I feel good. 2 years after the Loveland speech, Trump released Think Big, his 12th book. Think Big was co-authored by Bill Zanker, Z-A-N-K-E-R, founder of the Learning Annex, which runs classes on everything from pole dancing and making your own soap to writing business plans. Chapter 6 of Think Big is titled Revenge. I always get even, Trump writes in the opening line of that chapter. He then launches into an attack on the same woman he had denounced in Colorado. Trump recruited the unnamed woman, quote, from her government job where she was making peanuts, unquote, her career going nowhere. I decided to make her somebody. I gave her a great job at the Trump Organization, and over time she became powerful in real estate. She bought a beautiful home, unquote. When Trump was in financial trouble in the early 1990s, I asked her to make a phone call to an extremely close friend of hers who held a powerful position at a big bank and who would have done what she asked. She said, Donald, I can't do that. Instead of accepting that the woman felt such a call would be improper, Trump fired her. She started her own business. Trump writes that her business failed. I was really happy when I found that out, he says. In Trump's telling, the story of an employee declining to do something unseemly is really the story of a rebellion to be crushed. Trump wrote, she has turned on me after I had done so much to help her. I had asked her for one favor in return, and she turned me down flat. She ended up losing her home. Her husband, who was only in it for the money, walked out on her, and I was glad. Over the years, many people have called asking a recommendation for her. I only gave her bad recommendations. I can't stomach disloyalty. And now I go out of my way to make her life miserable. Trump devotes another several pages to actress Rosie O'Donnell, who described him as a snake oil salesman in 2006. A few months later at Zanker's 2007 Learning Annex Real Estate and Wealth Expo, Trump called O'Donnell a pig, a degenerate, a slob, and later on television, disgusting inside and out, unquote. He made disparaging remarks about her looks, weight, and sexuality, and said on national television that O'Donnell's emotional health would improve if she never looked in a mirror. In Think Big, Trump calls O'Donnell a bully. You've got to hit a bully really hard, really strongly, right between the eyes. I hit that horrible woman right smack in the middle of the eyes. It's true, some people would have ignored her insults. I decided to fight back and make her regret the day she decided to unload on me. At the end of the chapter, Trump writes, I love getting even when I get screwed by someone. Yeah, it's true. Always get even. When you are in business, you need to get even with people who screw you. You need to screw them back 15 times harder, go for the jugular, attack them in spades. Trump's words take on more significance when read in the context of his campaign statement, "No one reads the Bible more than I do," unquote. He says the Art of the Deal is the greatest book ever written except for the Bible. He has never been able to recite a biblical verse. Among the many biblical verses warning against vengeance is Romans 12:19, which in one modern translation states, "Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord." Just before the New York State primary election in April of 2016, Trump told Bob Lonsberry, L-O-N-S-B-E-R-R-Y, a radio host in Rochester, New York, that he was religious. "Is there a favorite Bible verse or favorite story that has informed your thinking or character?" Lonsberry asked. "Well, I think many," Trump replied. "I mean, when we get into the Bible, I think many, so many. And some people, look, an eye for an eye, you can almost say that. That's not a particularly nice thing, but you know, if you look at what's happening to our country, I mean, when you see what's going on with our country, how people are taking advantage of us, we have to be firm and have to be very strong. And we can learn a lot from the Bible, that I can tell you." His invocation of an eye for an eye alludes to Exodus 21:24. But Trump, who made a show of attending Presbyterian services once during the campaign, seemed unaware that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus repudiated this Old Testament verse, saying in one modern translation, and I'm not going to bother reading the Sermon on the Mount. It's pretty well known, although apparently not to Donald Trump.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Skipping down, 16 pages of Think Big are devoted to revenge. All of them run directly contrary to this basic biblical teaching. Trump leaves no room for doubt that revenge is a guiding principle of his life. "My motto is, always get even. When someone screws you, you get them back in spades." But that guiding principle stands in direct opposition to both Christian and Jewish theology. On another page of Think Big, Trump acknowledges that, quote, "This is not your typical advice, get even. But this is real-life advice. If you don't get even, you are just a schmuck. I really mean it, too." It will come as no surprise that Trump's views on revenge were not limited to employees he considered disloyal, people he had done deals with, or even petty insults by an actress. In fact, in the year 2000, Trump turned his revenge on his own family. Two of Donald Trump's mottos, "always get even" and "hit back harder than you were hit," came into play shortly after his father died in 1999 at the age of 93. More than 600 people filled Marble Collegiate Church in Manhattan, far from the outer boroughs where Fred Sr. had lived and owned apartments. Among those speaking was his namesake grandson, Fred Trump III, Donald's nephew, son of Fred Jr. He described his grandfather as a generous man who always took care of others. The next day, Fred III's wife, Lisa, who had been among the mourners, went into labor. By the way, Fred III is his nephew. The next day, Fred III's wife, Lisa, who had been among the mourners, went into labor. Less than 48 hours after William Trump was born, he began having seizures. In the months ahead, he would stop breathing twice. The medical bills that followed ran to nearly $250,000. Shortly after the medical problems arose, Donald's younger brother Robert called his nephew and said not to worry. All the medical bills would be covered. For decades, Fred Trump Sr. had provided every family member with medical insurance through his company, Apartment Management Associates. A letter from a Trump family lawyer instructed Precise, the Trump family medical plan that was part of the Trump business empire, to cover, quote, all costs related to baby William's care, notwithstanding any plan limits, percentage number of visits, or maximum dollar amount, whether or not they are deemed by Precise to be medically necessary. This directive shall remain in effect until further notice, unquote. The instruction was dated July 19, 1999, just 24 days after Fred Sr. died. Soon after that, Fred Sr.'s will was filed in probate court. Infant William's father and the other descendants of Fred Jr. discovered that they were not collecting their anticipated share of the estate. News reports valued Fred Sr.'s estate at somewhere between $100 million and $300 million. Its real value was no doubt more. Wealthy people contemplating the end of their lives routinely organize ownership of their assets so that tax authorities will accept values far below market rates. Generally speaking, this is achieved by complicating the ownership structure, supposedly making it hard for individual inheritors to cash out. That can lower estate values for tax purposes by two-thirds. Fred Trump Sr. had executed a will in 1984 after Fred Jr., his eldest son, died. That will left the bulk of his fortune to his four other children, Donald, Marianne, Robert, and Elizabeth. His final will, which was executed in 1991, well before Fred Sr. was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 1993, also split most of the money among those four. Little, if any, of the late Fred Jr.'s presumptive fifth of the fortune was left to his line, Fred III, and his sister Mary, who was named for Fred Sr.'s wife, received only $200,000, the same amount given to all the other grandchildren. Fred Sr.'s lawyer had drawn attention to the potential for litigation over the estate if the namesake son's line was cut out of the bulk of the Trump fortune. Given the size of your estate, he wrote, leaving Fred Jr.'s children such a relatively small sum, quote, is tantamount to disinheriting them. You may wish to increase their participation in your estate to avoid ill will in the future, unquote. The lawyer asked Fred Sr. to fill out a routine estate planning form that described his intentions. It included two boxes indicating whether he wanted to leave more money to Fred Jr.'s children, Fred III, and Mary. Fred Sr. did not check those boxes. When Fred III, Mary, and their mother, Linda, learned about the will, they filed a lawsuit confirming the lawyer's anticipation of trouble. The lawsuit asserted that Fred Sr. was not of sound mind and that his signature on the will dated September 18, 1991, had been, quote, procured by fraud and undue influence, unquote, by Donald and the other surviving siblings. It asked that Fred Jr.'s descendants inherit a fifth of the fortune. Donald Trump's reaction was swift and vengeful. On March 30, 2000, 1 week after the lawsuit was filed, Fred III received a certified letter stating that all medical benefits would cease on May 1st. for little William, that was a potential death sentence. Lisa Trump told Heidi Evans of the New York Daily News that she burst into tears, unquote, on learning that her sickly son was in jeopardy. The devastated parents filed a new lawsuit. They went to court not in Queens, where the Trump family's influence was substantial, but in Nassau County on Long Island. A judge signed an order directing that the medical coverage continue until the matter could be resolved. Fred III said, "You have to be tough in this family. I guess I had what my father, Fred Jr., didn't have. I will stick to my guns. I think it was just wrong," unquote. He also observed of his paternal aunts and uncles, "These are not warm and fuzzy people. They never even came to see William in the hospital. Our family puts the fun in dysfunctional." Mary said that the issue was money, of course, which was central to Fred Sr. and his four surviving children. "Given this family, it would be utterly naive to say it has nothing to do with money," she said. "But for both me and my brother, it has much more to do with that our father, Fred Jr., be recognized. He existed, he lived, he was their oldest son, and William is my father's grandson. He is as much a part of that family as anybody else, and he desperately needs extra care," unquote. Also speaking with Evans at the New York Daily News, Mary Trump said, quote, "My aunts and uncles should be ashamed of themselves. I am sure that they are not," unquote. Evans asked Donald Trump about this. He said that when he learned of the lawsuit over the will, his reaction was, "Why should we give him medical coverage?" unquote. Pressed about whether it would appear cold-hearted to withdraw the medical insurance of a sickly child, Trump did not waver. "I can't help that. It's cold when someone sues my father," he replied. He then added a revealing comment about the position of power that he was in compared to his nephew and his desperately ill grandnephew. Referring to Fred III, Donald said, "Had he come to see me, things could very possibly have been much different for them. It's sort of disappointing. They sued my father, essentially. I'm not thrilled when someone sues my father," unquote. Donald said he was doing nothing but carrying out the wishes of his father. "I have helped Fred III over the years," he said. "That was the will of my father. He had four children left, and that's who he wanted to leave his estate to." Trump said nothing about whether he or his siblings might have had any familial or moral obligation to advise his nephew of Fred Sr.'s plans, especially since he stood to add millions to his own inheritance if the fortune was cut into fourths rather than fifths. Mary Ann Trump Berry, parenthetically a judge, we will come to her later in the book, beginning again, Mary Ann Trump Berry weighed in too. She said that Fred Jr.'s children, Mary and Fred III, were, quote, absentee grandchildren, unquote, whom the grandparents saw only on holidays. Donald, testifying under oath in the lawsuit challenging Fred Sr.'s will, made it clear that he thought that Fred Jr.'s children had benefited more than enough from the family fortune. "They lived like kings and queens," he said under oath. "This is not two people left out in the gutter," unquote. Years later, while seeking the Republican presidential nomination, Trump was asked about the estate tax dispute and the withdrawal of medical coverage for little William. Trump was unapologetic, a stance consistent with his statements that he had never had a reason to seek God's forgiveness and never has. Quote, "Why do I have to repent or seek God's forgiveness if I am not making mistakes?" Trump asked an Iowa audience of evangelicals in 2015. The report on this in the Christian Post quoted his words, then referred to Trump's alleged Christian faith, unquote. Trump said his peak of the challenge to his father's will motivated the termination of all medical benefits for the sick child. I was angry because they sued, he told journalist Jason Horowitz. Fred Jr.'s line was cut out of the will, Donald said, not because he and the surviving siblings had exercised any influence over their father, but because Fred Sr. had a, quote, tremendous dislike, unquote, for the flight attendant his son had married. In that, Fred Sr. would have been channeling his own paternal grandmother, who disapproved of his father Friedrich's choice of the German-born Elizabeth Christ as his wife. Trump went on to say that the cases were settled, quote, very amicably, unquote. Neither Fred III nor his mother would comment when asked about Donald's remarks, which would be consistent with a settlement requiring no public disclosure by any of the parties. The very amicable, unquote, terms remain unknown because the settlement was sealed. What provisions, if any, were made for the lifelong care of William, whose seizures eventually developed into cerebral palsy, are also unknown. Donald Trump's application of his motto of vengeance on his blood relatives, a motto directly contrary to the most basic teaching of all Christian faiths, caused deep division within his family. In contrast to this, he had years earlier developed a close relationship with one of the most vicious and heartless men who ever lived in America, a mentor who also believed revenge was the best policy, and who became a kind of second father to Donald Trump, the notorious Roy Cohn. And then in Chapter 5, Making Friends. In 1970, 2 years after getting his college degree from Penn, Donald Trump was still living in Queens. He was an outer borough guy, part of the group derided as bridge and tunnel people, unquote, by the stylish Manhattanites. Trump wanted to join and eventually lead that fashionable tribe. Trump has boasted often that he was on the hunt almost every night for beautiful young women, unquote, but he was also trying to make other significant connections. One of the first and most important connections was with the notorious attorney Roy Cohn. Cohn had been the chief lawyer for Senator Joseph McCarthy, whose communist witch hunts only ended when he went after the U.S. Army. By Trump's account, Cohn became a business mentor and nearly a second father to him. Their steadily deepening relationship would link Trump to mob-owned construction companies at a time when other builders were begging the FBI to crack down on the mafia. It also ensnared Trump in a jewelry tax scam and in a lawsuit that blew up in his face. In Cohn, Trump had someone who could be vicious, unquote, on his behalf, and who he said, looking back in 2005, would brutalize for you, unquote. While the timeline is fuzzy, Trump says that to become part of the Manhattanite crowd, he rented what he called a crummy little apartment with a view of a water tank at 3rd Avenue and 75th Street on the east side. Then he set out to join Le Club, which Trump regarded as, quote, the hottest club in the city and perhaps the most exclusive, like Studio 54 at its height. Its membership included some of the most successful men and most beautiful women in the world. It was the sort of place where you were more likely to see a wealthy 75-year-old guy walk in with three blondes from Sweden, unquote. At the club, Trump met and studied a lot of rich men from New York and abroad, including Cohn, whom he had known by reputation. I don't kid myself about Roy, Trump wrote. He was no Boy Scout. He once told me he spent more than two-thirds of his adult life under indictment on one charge or another, unquote. Such a revelation might repulse some people, but Trump's reaction was, "That amazed me," unquote. Trump first hired Cohen to sue the federal government. In the summer of 1972, the federal government investigated claims of racial bias involving a number of apartment house operators, including the Trumps, who owned 14,000 apartments in Brooklyn. It was not the first allegation of Trump bias. Fred Trump had faced similar accusations two decades earlier, both from the government and from legendary folk singer Woody Guthrie. Guthrie had moved into an apartment at Beach Haven, Fred Trump's major housing project, in 1950, soon after the six-building, 1,800-unit apartment project was completed. Guthrie noticed that everyone around him was white and started writing about the rental policies at what he called Bitch Havens, unquote. I suppose that old man Trump knows just how much racial hate he stirred up in the blood pot of human hearts when he drawed that color line here at his Beach Haven family project. Guthrie is best known for This Land is Your Land, his ballad about the Dust Bowl, which gave farmers in his native Oklahoma an extra kick in the pants during the Great Depression. He set his thoughts about Trump's mental policies to a song he titled Old Man Trump. The lyrics continue with this: Beach Haven ain't my home. No, I just can't pay this rent. My money's down the drain. My soul is badly bent. Beach Haven is Trump's tower where no black folks come to roam. No, no, old man Trump. Old Beach Haven ain't my home. More than two decades later, in July of 1972, the federal government authorized a series of field tests for compliance with the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which Congress had passed into law 1 week after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. In these tests, a black woman or man or couple was sent to ask about renting an apartment. When they were told none were available, whites with the same information about their employment and income showed up. At Trump's Shorehaven Apartments, the superintendent told a white woman she could have her pick of two units shortly after a black woman had been told there were no vacancies. The Trumps did rent to African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and others not considered white, but only in certain buildings that were heavily minority, government investigators said. Court records showed that minority applicants were routinely steered to those other properties. The Justice Department sued Donald Trump, his father, and Trump management, quote, for refusing to rent dwellings and negotiate the rental of dwellings with persons because of race and color, unquote. The case, filed in October of 1973, was one of the highest profile racial discrimination cases of the many filed in federal courthouse in the wake of the Fair Housing Act. Most big landlords settled quickly to avoid nasty publicity, agreeing to keep track of the racial mix of tenants, to advertise to non-whites, and to take other steps to comply with federal laws. But Donald Trump sought advice from Cohen in what he says was their first conversation, even though Trump has testified under oath that he met Cohen 3 years earlier. Trump wrote that he told Cohen, "I don't like lawyers because they delay deals, say no, and are always looking to settle instead of fight," unquote. Trump surprised him by expressing agreement, asked for his advice on what to do about the discrimination lawsuit, which Trump says an unnamed Wall Street law firm had advised settling. Trump said, "Tell them to go to hell and fight the thing in court and let them prove that you discriminated," unquote, adding that Trump had no obligation to, quote, rent to tenants who would be undesirable white or black, unquote. Cohen also counseled that the accusation of racist practices would stick with Trump, so the young real estate mogul needed to defend his name. 2 months after this supposed first conversation with Cohn, Trump held a press conference at the New York Hilton where he accused the Justice Department of fabricating a case just to force him and his father to rent the people on welfare, even though the case was about racial discrimination, not welfare. Cohn filed a lawsuit demanding $100 million in damages from the federal government. This marked a key moment in Trump's career, adopting a tactic that would be a core tenet of his 2016 presidential bid, hitting back harder when he feels attacked. The government's lawsuit and Trump's countersuit were heard in federal court in Brooklyn a few weeks later. Cohn squared off against a 26-year-old government lawyer on her first big case, an uneven match of experience that should have benefited the Trump side. In a sworn statement, Trump asserted that neither he nor his company, quote, to the best of my knowledge, discriminated or has shown bias in renting our apartments, unquote. The judge was savvy enough to note the key phrase in the affidavit, which was Trump's knowledge, not any actual discrimination by the company and its employees. Cohn argued that the government census of Trump's tenants was unnecessary because the Trumps had seen black people in several of their buildings. He added that he had personally driven by and seen black people walking into or out of some, unquote, Trump buildings without specifying whether these were the buildings where the lawsuit said blacks were steered or the ones the government said were kept all white. Other facts pointed to Trump's wrongdoing. The government had been told by Trump employees that when blacks insisted on filling out an application at one of the whites-only Trump buildings, the applications were coded with number 9 or, quote, C, unquote. Elise Goldweber, G-O-L-D-W-E-B-E-R, the novice Justice Department lawyer, told the court that one employee who spoke to investigators was not being named because, quote, he was afraid that the Trumps would have him knocked off, or words to that effect, for revealing the techniques used to deny blacks and other minorities. Cohn's response was to accuse another government lawyer of soliciting false testimony and conducting Gestapo-like interrogation of Trump employees. Federal Judge Edward R. Neher, N-E-A-H-E-R, dismissed as utterly without foundation Cohn's claims of official misconduct. Judge Neher also dismissed Trump's countersuit and allowed the government to proceed with the original suit and investigation, satisfied that enough evidence existed for that case to go forward. We're going to continue with our sequential reading of The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston in weeks to come. I may decide to alternate readings from this very important book, which I emphatically encourage people to go out, buy, tell other people about, share on the internet. It is very important, and again, I get nothing from this, neither do any of the stations. This concludes For the Record 932, The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 1, being recorded on November 16th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.